So besides being an author, Reverend Adam is the president of Sojourners Magazine. And it's also not just a magazine, but it's a mobilizing organization. The mobilizing arm is called Sojo Action. I would love to explore and actually talk more about Sojo Action towards the end, or maybe we can even infuse it, because I was on, I get the magazine, I get Sojourners, but I don't think I really spent a lot of time on Sojo Action. And so I think that's really gonna kind of infuse into our conversation. If you're not getting Sojourners, I encourage it. So please, it's such a great, great resource. Adam previously led the Faith Initiative at the World Bank Group and served as the vice president in charge of advocacy at World Vision US and the senior political director at Sojourners. He served as the executive director of Global Justice, an organization that educates and mobilizes students around global human rights and economic justice. He was selected for the 2009-2010 class of White House Fellows and served in the White House Official of Cabinet Affairs and Public Engagement. Adam is the graduate of Emory University, the Harvard University Kennedy School of Government, and the Samuel DeWitt Proctor School of Theology. Adam also serves on the Independent Sector Board, the Global Advisory Board of Tearfund UK, and is a member of the inaugural class of the Aspen Institute Civil Society Fellowship. Adam is ordained in the American Baptist Church and the Progressive National Baptist Convention and serves in ministry at the Alfred Street Baptist Church in Alexandria, Virginia. So welcome to this group. Most of us are Methodists.
I love Methodists too. I really mean that.
And we do have Reverend Chelsea and Reverend Claire who are on here. They are two deacons in the United Methodist Church and the CalPAC Conference. And I actually am at seminary at Duke Divinity right now on the deacon track as well. So you got a handful of us. All right.
I was going to say, after that bio, Adam, I feel lazy.
I know. You haven't done anything.
Hey, to God the glory.
Yeah.
So I want to open it up because I think it might be helpful if you could provide some context on what led you to write this book, and how would you define the goal or the telos or aim of the book, and what's the audience that you were targeting? Maybe just give us some context.
Yeah, well, first, it's a privilege, joy to be with you all virtually. I always yearn to be in person again, but hopefully we are going to get to that place. And just, you know, this may or may not be heavy on your hearts right now, but one of the chapters in the book is called Prioritizing Nonviolence. And so certainly my prayers continue to go out to the people of Ukraine and praying for peace in the midst of that horrific conflict and now invasion. So I chose this background for a reason. It's one of my favorite images from the civil rights struggle. And I tell a little bit of this story in the book. So again, forgive me if I end up repeating some things you've recently read, but I'm anxious to get into a further dialogue with you about the book and its themes. But to understand why I wrote it, I really have to kind of tell my own origin story. So I have two sons. They're now 9 and 11. We're a huge Marvel universe family. We actually have a dog who is named Marvel, who might come in at any point. And so to really understand my reasons for writing the book, it is kind of traced back to my parents. So my father is white, my mother's Black. They made the controversial decision to marry each other in 1968, just a year after interracial marriage was legalized across the country through the Loving versus the State of Virginia Supreme Court case. And they instilled in me this deep and abiding belief that all of us are made in the image of God, and that my diversity, in a larger sense, our nation's diversity, is a strength. It's like literally our superpower, not a liability. And that my generation, and I'm not going to presume anyone else's age on this virtual screen, but at least Generation X inherited the unfinished business of the civil rights struggle. And so I really, really internalized that when I was growing up. I never quite could imagine that part of that ongoing unfinished business would be to continue to protect the right to vote. And I'll say more about that in a second. But I was really clear that part of my sense of calling was to try to push forward so much of that work around fighting poverty and advancing economic justice that Dr. King was fighting for before his assassination, obviously organizing the Poor People's Campaign that took over Washington, D.C. in the mall for a number of weeks. It was also about extending a kind of global understanding of human rights and of combating militarism, materialism, and racism, which he described as the three triplets. And so, you know, I really kind of believed in the power of the civil rights struggle as the example, or one of the shining examples, of what it looks like to put faith in action for justice and for peace. So, you know, fast forward a number of years, and I won't go through kind of all of what you just heard in terms of my bio, but when 2016 happened, I was working at the World Bank leading an initiative that was an ambitious one. I was kind of charged to build dialogue and foster partnerships between the World Bank and pretty much every religion in the world, across every region of the world, across all the different sectors the World Bank works on. It was literally kind of a mission impossible, but really meaningful work. And I was involved still in Sojourners because I was on the board at that time and was kind of watching carefully the 2016 election. And the morning of the election, I tell the story in the book. By then, my older son, who was 5 years old at the time, Joshua, came into my wife and I's room at 3 a.m. And if you could just kind of transport yourself back, I know that might not be a pleasant experience, but transport you back to that moment. And he was distraught. He was like, "Mommy and Daddy, I need to know who won the election." And we were kind of struggling with it ourselves. And we said, "Well, we think Mr. Trump won." And he said, "I don't understand how someone who has said and done such mean things could win." And then I'm rarely speechless, particularly as a preacher, but I didn't know what to say. I didn't know how to console him in that moment. And he saw a reaction. He was like, "Well, don't worry. It's okay, because you're going to make it okay." And I literally kind of felt the weight of the world on my shoulders in that moment. And what I realized is that I wasn't anguished because someone who is more politically conservative than I am won, or that a Republican won. I don't see myself as a strong partisan. I was anguished because someone won with a very dystopian and ahistorical narrative, i.e. Make America Great Again, that stoked a lot of the worst vices and idolatries in American culture and history, namely kind of stoking racism, xenophobia, and misogyny. And I felt as though, now this has been kind of overused in some ways, but really the kind of the soul of our nation was at stake. And in some ways our democracy is at stake. And I didn't know the degree to which our democracy was at stake then, but we're kind of seeing that even more now. And so I wrote the book in part because I really believe in the power of what's called public narrative, that narratives shape our understanding of ourselves, our understanding of what's possible. They shape our worldview, and that you can only replace, or in a different sense, defeat a negative narrative with a more unifying, positive, and transformational one. And kind of tying into my studies of the civil rights struggle, I have always been inspired by the narrative that animated that struggle, which is the narrative of the beloved community, the moral vision of the beloved community. And one of the reasons why I think our country has become so severely divided and polarized, I call it toxic polarization, is that we don't have a shared baseline of memory and understanding of our nation's history and how injustice from the past continues to show up in the present. And we don't have a shared moral vision about where we're going. And look, I'm not naive. I'm not arguing that every single American is going to necessarily unite around the exact same moral vision, but that we don't actually need that to happen. I think there's a critical mass of us, the majority of Americans, that would resonate with this beloved community vision because it is anchored in our shared civic values and our shared religious values. And so what I try to do in this book is to recast, reimagine what that beloved community vision could look like for us today, building, of course, on the inspiration of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., but also leaders like Ella Baker and Fannie Lou Hamer and so many others, Congressman John Lewis. What I make the case for is that not only do we need to rearticulate that vision, but we also need to break it apart, if you will, into these various components that we can actually measure and that we can actually embrace. So just really quickly, my most succinct definition of what the beloved community is all about is building a community, building a nation in which neither punishment nor privilege is tied to race, to ethnicity, to gender, to sexuality, to ableness, to all those kind of core parts of our identity. And it's about, in a kind of more positive sense, creating a nation, a society where everyone is seen, everyone is respected, everyone is enabled to thrive and realize their full God-given potential. And it's where we see our diversity as a real strength and not as a weakness. And so, you know, for me, like, what's so powerful about the beloved community is it combines these two words, community, which is something that we all yearn for. It's kind of innate within us to yearn for community. And the word beloved, that we are all beloved by God, that we are made in the very image and likeness of God. And one of the what I call the Beatitudes of Beloved Community literally is the Imago Dei commitment to equality. And so, you know, as I kind of wrote the book, what I realized is that there's already all of these amazing, inspiring people that I am fortunate to be in relationship with that are doing the work of the Beloved Community. And, you know, I only have a snapshot of what's happening, but I wanted to make it real. I wanted to show that there is incredible work happening that doesn't capture the headlines a lot of people don't know about, but I try to feature a lot of these people. And actually some of them come from this fellowship program that I'm a part of called the Aspen Institute Civil Society Fellowship. Amazing group of people that I've been able to get to know and now admire. And I get to tell some of their stories, particularly in the third part of the book. And for me, there is this kind of beloved community revolution that is already bubbling up. It's not yet at that tipping point, you know, using that common phrase, but I believe that we can get there. And I believe it could be the most powerful antidote to so many of the negative things that we see in our politics and our culture and in the church. And it could be that powerful vision that could help transform our politics, the church, and our culture. So let me stop there. I'd love to hear more of your questions. So,
And if anybody has a question, feel free to put it in the chat or interrupt me, of course. This is a near and dear topic to me, and I'll hopefully be able to give you examples as the conversation goes on. But I think one of my questions is, when you're thinking about who is going to read this book, who are you thinking is going to read? Is it us who's on, like, you know, maybe we're starting to do the work. I'm going to give us a little bit of credit. Like, we're starting, or we're not even there, but we know we're going to try. Is it, like, tell me who's not going to read it? And what challenges does that create? And then I'm digressing a little bit, but I think you know where I'm
going. No, it's a great question. It's a really good question. So that honestly was the hardest kind of needle to thread as I wrote this book, because I felt like I had to do some real truth telling about our nation's history, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Again, you know, I quote Maya Angelou, you can't know where you're going unless you know where you've been. And we have this battle over truth and history right now, showing up in, you know, school board fights around whether we're really gonna teach the fullness of our history. And, you know, this kind of boogeyman of critical race theory, which is not being taught, but is being used as a way to then shut down real teaching about the history of slavery and Jim Crow and other things. So I knew that I had to do truth telling, but I also didn't want to write this book in a way that was, you know, but I didn't want the tone of it to be one of blame and inciting guilt. Because ultimately, I believe this beloved community vision is one that really can appeal to and resonate with a lot of people that may have different worldviews than I do, or be more ideologically conservative than I am. And so my hope was that, you know, this book could reach, you know, the kind of core Sojourners audience, which is like deeply committed to justice, inspired by the faith. You know, they vary politically, but I would say kind of center left is where center to, you know, maybe even far left is kind of our constituency. But I also wanted to reach, like, you know, some of the folks that are independents, that are moderates, that are just really fed up with the current state of our politics, and even some conservatives. Maybe not, you know, I don't think, you know, I never expected to reach like the dye-in-the-wool Trumpers or the religious right per se.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of Christians that are theologically and socially conservative that are deeply concerned about the state of our country. And we're deeply concerned under Trump, to be honest. But many of them chose the path of being apolitical, to kind of step away from politics as their way of maybe coping with some of the craziness that we saw, but also out of a genuine desire not to exacerbate the divisions that already exist within their churches. And I understand, and there's a part of me that's empathetic to that approach. The danger, though, is that those very same pastors and church leaders have the, I would argue, the greatest ability to help shape and change the mindset of their congregations. And, you know, they can't do that single-handedly, but they have such incredible influence. And of course, you know, I believe that we follow a gospel that has profound political, economic, and social implications. That following Jesus really is and requires of us to be engaged in the work of justice, of righteousness, and of steadfast love. And so when you decide to kind of stand back, you are essentially giving license to the status quo, whether you like it or not. And so, you know, part of what I'm trying to do with this book is maybe reach some of those folks to say, you know, hey, you got to get off the sidelines, and here are some ways in which you can. And here is, you know, a kind of scripturally based, values based vision that I really think could help unify, you know, many of our communities and many of our congregations.
And that resonates with me, because I can definitely see it for individuals who are on the sidelines, and that I'll include myself. I'm trying to engage, but I know there's always more that I could be doing, and so that resonates with me. And I will be honest. I mean, we are in Southern California, and you would think like, oh, this is California. It's so liberal. It's so progressive. And yet we have a very strong, aggressive, fundamentalist, conservative voice here, and certainly in the Christian realm. And so our school boards right now are facing all of that. And so it's real, and it's even happening right here in Southern California, where a lot of people are like, what? No, not here. No, it's alive and well. And so I do, I just had a conversation with a friend the other day. I was like, what churches are these people going to, and what are their pastors saying? And I do wonder if even the pastors sometimes are afraid to be too outspoken, and does this resonate with them? I don't know if you've encountered any of that, but it was just a thought that I was, you know, contemplating.
Yeah, no, well, and one chapter that kind of might be helpful and informative in this part of the conversation is, I used to have all the chapters memorized, but it's a chapter that's focused on debunking the myths in America, right?
I think it's chapter 5 or 6.
Thank you, Dana, I appreciate that. So that chapter is based on a course that I teach at Pepperdine University. I don't get to go to Malibu, California, sadly, but I teach it here in DC. They have a campus here in DC where students do internships, and then I teach a class at night. And really amazing students, very bright. But I will admit, I am kind of flabbergasted about how little they know about some really key and fundamental parts of our history. Yeah. Most of them, and I kind of do a survey, I know it's not a scientific survey, but it's, you know, a more informal one, but right, majority of them don't know much about the period of Reconstruction. They don't know really about the origins of the religious right movement, that it wasn't founded on opposition to abortion, but it was actually founded to protect Christian colleges from having to desegregate during the 1960s and 70s. They don't know, you know, much about the women's movement and struggle. So, and I'm not blaming them. I'm just saying there really is this kind of, I think, deep disconnect and failure within our education system to do just basic civic education. And I don't want to go on a tangent there, but where I wanted to focus on is that one of the books I teach from is called The Myths America Lives by Richard Hughes. And in that book, he unpacks just how powerful and how internalized these myths are that shape our understanding of kind of what America is and what it means. Right. So he talks about, and some of these will be familiar to you, but the myth that we are a chosen nation, this kind of ties into American exceptionalism, certainly, you know, was very strong among the Puritans, but also among many of the settlers of the United States. This myth that we're an innocent nation, that we can do no wrong, that we've been, again, kind of tied to this chosenness. A myth that we're a Christian nation. We weren't founded as a Christian nation. We're founded intentionally as a nation that respects the separation of church and state. And even when we were founded, there was a decent degree of religious pluralism. And so you combine all these myths together, and they've been used to prop up the doctrine of manifest destiny. They've been used to justify white supremacy. It's actually really fascinating because Richard Hughes wrote the first edition of the book, and then got a lot of feedback, particularly from some of his Black colleagues, who were like, you talk a lot about racism in the book, but you don't name white supremacy as probably the founding myth of our country. And so he wrote another edition to his credit, and literally corrected it and said, look, this is really the primary myth, if you will. And I'm mentioning this because it's like, these have become seeped into the kind of civic religion of America. And a lot of, I think, Christians, particularly on the right, really conflate what is this civic religion with a distorted understanding of their own faith or of the Bible itself.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this isn't going to change overnight, but I think we really have to disconnect what you know, this kind of distorted civic religion from our understanding of the Christian faith and what it means to be a follower of Jesus, which certainly means, in my estimation, not living underneath a flag or allowing a flag to kind of, you know, drive your faith and your politics. Right. And so anyway, I mean, that's just one important example of where I think we've got to raise greater sense of awareness about these things that, you know, are just kind of in the air we breathe as Americans that we can take for granted. Right.
I was gonna say they are in our DNA. I mean, mm-hmm. I truly believe that our body now processes that kind of, you know, and so it's just and we'll continue on. I wanted to say, and this may, so you state sadly in recent years the church's moral authority has been compromised by a series of scandals and challenges, and then you also say America is becoming less religious, but spiritually seems to be deepening and thriving. So how do you see these facts as a challenge and a strengthening to the vision of becoming a more perfect union? Like how are they not so great? And then how can we actually use them as an opportunity?
Yeah, so I mean, it pains me that at least one branch of the church in particular has, you know, I would argue kind of sold out to and been co-opted into the Republican Party, and then more recently into
Trumpism,
right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, no, it's exactly right. And so that process, I think, has really tainted the reputation of the church. And it is, you know, also tied to perceptions, particularly among young people, that, you know, the church, and when we talk about the church, I mean, this is particularly an evangelical challenge, although it also is impacting mainline churches and the Catholic Church as well. But that, you know, the church is, and actually Barna did a study of this about 10 years ago, where the three most common adjectives among young people's attitude toward the church was that it was homophobic, it was hypocritical, and overly judgmental. Now, is that really what we want to be defined by or known as, right? Is that really what Jesus stood for? Of course not, yeah. Right? Yeah. And so I think part of what has driven this exodus of young people out of the church is the sense of the church is not, you know, it's being defined by what it's against rather than what it's for, and is not aligned with what they see as what it means to follow Jesus. Yeah. And so, you know, while that there's a real danger there, there's an opportunity because many of them still are fairly religious in one sense. They're just not going to a church.
Right.
You know, this kind of growing denomination, if you will, of spiritual but not religious. Many of them, when you actually talk to them, you know, still feel a real connection to Jesus. But again, they've been really disillusioned by organized religion. And so there's a study that the Fetzer Institute did a couple of years ago, and I had the privilege of being on the advisory board for the study, and it was on spirituality in America. And what they found is that spirituality is actually growing stronger across the country, and that there's a high correlation between spirituality and positive, effective behavior and civic engagement. So in other words, the more spiritual you are, the more likely you are going to be engaged in service, you know, of various types, the more likely you are to vote and be involved in a political campaign. Now, I didn't get into details about like what issues you're involved in, but I think that's actually some encouraging news because, you know, people that are spiritual or see themselves as spiritual find a sense of meaning and belonging by being engaged with others, by helping others, by trying to make change through their activism. And so that's a really positive part. And this is, you know, something I believe in really strongly, and this is something we're trying to do as Sojourners. I really believe that, and there is some data to back this up, if the church was to become much more of that inclusive space that was deeply committed to justice, I believe that would be one of the most powerful forms of evangelism, to invite those, you know, disaffected, disillusioned folks to come back in the church. And we're seeing that happen in some places, but I don't think there's enough good models for what that actually looks like in practice. And, you know, Sojourners is trying to offer resources and tools to help churches become that future. But to me, that is the hopeful side. And, you know, even if not everyone comes back to the church, but, you know, is still, you know, active in putting their spirituality or their faith into action for justice, that's certainly fine too. But anyway, that's where I see the greatest hope.
So I'm taking evangelism this semester, and we had to read Faith Rooted Organizing by Alexia Salvatierra mm-hmm. and Peter Hetzel. And so I just wrote a paper on it. And oh, nice. And that's how we're thinking of evangelism, because, you know, in the church, evangelism, I mean, I'm going to be honest with you, right? So evangelism is not a word I like to use. You know, it's not a word that I don't feel growing up United Methodist, we've always kind of shied away from, but yet here, thinking about it as putting our faith in action, it just really changes the entire frame. And so I went on to Sojo Action, and right there is Faith Rooted Organizing. There's a whole toolkit. And one of the things I wrote in the paper is I said, I'd love it if there was a how-to guide, and here it is. So thank you for that.
Absolutely. Well, and you'll hopefully be pleasantly, you'll love to hear that Reverend Alexia is literally the co-chair of our board. So she is a beloved part of Sojourners.
And that is so great. It was just a very, and so here I am, awakening up to that work. So it's, anyway, thank you. So any questions on that? Does anybody have any questions? Chelsea?
I was just thinking, Dana and I talk a lot about how we so appreciate having one another as friends, because we get to talk about our faith together in community. And I hear what you're saying, that young people perhaps could come back to the church if, you know, we have a drastic change of like justice first and inclusion first and all these things. Do you think that that's the way forward, or do you think that there's something emerging that isn't church? Like there's something kind of new maybe happening. I'm just wondering what you're seeing as you kind of probably have like a more national global lens on that.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's a both end approach, where I think some will come back to church as the church changes and is more inclusive, welcoming, et cetera. And others are kind of doing church in very new ways. And so, you know, for example, you know, I have really experienced a deep sense of faith and spirituality within many of the Black Lives Matter protests and community, where, you know, again, it's not expressed as we might kind of see church, of course, but this deep sense of connection and solidarity and belonging. And, you know, in some cases, an explicit reference to really trying to tap into the power of the Holy Spirit and, you know, a sense of faith being core to what they're doing. And so, you know, I think it's positive that people are experiencing faith and spirituality in new ways. And I think the more the church can not just understand it, but be able to learn from it and maybe even kind of model some of that would be a positive thing.
Yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think I was read or heard somewhere that the Black Lives Matter movement is the largest movement in, you know, I think since the civil rights and MLK, and it wasn't, you know, it was based on the murder of Trayvon Martin, but it wasn't really founded in the Christian religious faith tradition. And so that's kind of a movement that a lot of other actions were founded more in a faith-based tradition, and this was not.
No, that's right. That's right. I mean, certainly many of the founders and all are people of faith, but also are, you know, are people that were kind of marginalized by their churches, including many of the founders were, you know, lesbian or trans. And so, you know, I think one of the things that's so inspiring about the BLM movement is that, you know, there's this deep commitment to radical inclusiveness and just a real clear commitment not to negotiate around who is included or who's not, or who can exercise leadership. I mean, and I talk about this a little bit in my book, but like, you know, I think there are some things that we need to put in the past that were quite prevalent in the civil rights movement, particularly the degree of sexism and homophobia that was prevalent in the movement at that time. And, you know, that yes, in one sense was a product of their time, but also, you know, let's not, we need a change. Like, it's a positive thing that the Black Lives Matter movement is more leaderful, in my opinion, and is really inclusive, and in some ways centers the voices of those who have been most marginalized traditionally. So yeah, I think there's a lot that we can learn from these new efforts, these new models, even wineskins. Like, you know, let's talk Jesus. Like,
yeah,
let's not, you know, keep putting wine into old wineskins. It's gonna spoil. We need some new wineskins.
That's a great way to, again, it takes the positive, it takes the goodness, it takes the optimism. And yeah, so, oh, that's great. Okay. Any other questions? So I want to talk a little bit about individual and collective. You write about moving from an individual to a collective understanding, and you call out, and you quote, many churches that still focus on personal behavior rather than on social systems. And we already started talking a little bit about this. And again, growing up in a Methodist and predominantly white congregation, which is what I'm in now, I acknowledge that even while we have been called to help and support our neighbors, whether it's donating to the local food pantry or having a bake sale for the winter shelter, I do feel like the intent or what was instilled in me was that it was to build a personal relationship with God, not on what's happening in our society, which is, you know, how are we allowing, what's happening systemically that we're allowing people to go without food, that we're allowing people to not be housed. And this is really kind of the collective sin. So I wanted to talk a little bit more about that, and then maybe even getting into how we mobilize into the discomfort, because I think as privileged people, I'm a privileged person, I have to get uncomfortable and I have to vote and get active, and it's not voting in my favor, like in my benefit, to benefit me. It's voting to help others.
Yeah, so, you know, one of the, I think, challenges, which again, kind of goes back to some of that DNA of America, this kind of rugged individualism of America.
Yeah.
We have, you know, theologized that in some ways, where, you know, we really have this distorted lens through which we read scripture that often kind of focuses overly on the individual, you know, the personal relationship with Christ, for example, rather than, you know, emphasizing that that personal relationship is always meant to then, or the, it then enlists us in God's kingdom reign purposes in the world of justice and peace and righteousness. Even the way that we so often interpret or translate the word righteousness, so the word tzedek and tzedekah, which is found hundreds of times in the Old Testament, we often kind of privatize it, that it's really about personal piety. When a better interpretation or better translation of righteousness is really about how things ought to be. It has a communal nature to it. And so when you reinterpret so many texts thinking about righteousness as something that is communal rather than personal, it really changes the meaning, right?
Yeah.
So I think, you know, some of this is like, you know, the blinders we have because of cultural challenges. Some of it's the blinders we have because of theological challenges. But let's just use the racial awakening summer of 2022 after the horrific murder of George Floyd and others.
Right.
I don't refer to it as a reckoning because I don't think we've actually seen the kind of change in public policy that would be necessary for reckoning to happen. I think it was a partial awakening, which is still important and beneficial. As you said, it was the largest mass protest our country, our nation has seen since the civil rights struggle. What was disappointing and kind of proves the point I'm about to make is that among white evangelicals, their opinion about whether policing was a problem or there's kind of a systemic problem with policing didn't budge almost at all. And among white mainline Christians, it changed by about 15 to 20 points. And then a couple of, you know, about 6 months later, it basically went back to where it was before. And so the amount of awakening that happened was unfortunately somewhat shallow and superficial.
Yeah.
And I think it stems in part from our inability to see that, you know, in this example, the system of policing is being broken fundamentally. Mm-hmm. And being racially biased fundamentally, and that has to change. And then unfortunately, no amount of service or charity, as important as those things are for our faith, is going to change and transform that system of policing. It literally has to come down to laws being changed. Yes, the kind of hearts and minds of police officers are also important in that equation. But if they continue to be beholden to the interests of police unions, and if there continues to be impunity for those bad actors that do end up, you know, killing people unnecessarily or illegally, et cetera, then the system really isn't going to change. I'll just use one more example. So I've done a lot of training with churches around what I describe as prophetic advocacy. And, you know, at the beginning of the training, I will ask them, how many of you are involved in a social justice ministry or have a social justice ministry? And, you know, inevitably, majority of hands will go up. And I'll be like, well, tell me about that ministry. And they'll talk about the soup kitchen in their church. And they'll talk about the homeless ministry in their church and the mentoring they're doing with young people. And I always say, like, those are beautiful, beautiful expressions of following Christ and of being committed to compassion and mercy. But they are not social justice ministries in the way that I understand them. Because at the root of a commitment to justice is a commitment to both identify and to redress root causes of injustice, which often are tied to some form of exploitation, some form of domination, some form of exclusion from community, and even some form of violence. And so if you don't figure out and address some of those root causes, you're not doing the kind of deeper biblical work of justice. And it's not to pit that against service. We need the service. We need the compassion. Right. Of course, we need to meet immediate needs, right? But we've got to build up the skill set to be able to address those root causes and to better see the systemic issues that are so often at play. So, you know, that's some of what I actually tried to do with my first book, Mobilizing Hope, which came out about 10 years ago. And, you know, there's other great books out there, like the one you just named, Dana, on faith-rooted organizing by Reverend Alexia. And so anyway, I think this is a moment where we've got to go deeper in both our analysis and our ability to see systems and in our skill set to be able to help change them and transform them.
And I think my follow-up question, and maybe this lets us transition, is how do we do that? Like coming, you know, and right. I say that authentically. I say that authentically as a white woman in a predominantly white community. This is the work that you're 100% right. And so I just found the faith-rooted organizing toolkit. And so I'm like, okay, I've got to start pouring through this, but how do we start to engage in this? Cause it has to get deeper and it's challenging.
Yeah. Yeah. So we've got a program that we just rebooted called the Faith-Rooted Advocates Program, or FRAN, which is our effort to try to connect folks like yourselves with Sojourners so that we can be in relationship and in community with each other to then equip and to mobilize you to be able to use your voice to affect national change in particular. We're not really set up to do deep local work. Other organizations are, and you know, there's wonderful ones out there like Faith in Action and others. But I think our strength is being able to equip and inform and mobilize in order to impact federal policy. And so, and I'll give you an example. You know, I wish that we were a heck of a lot stronger than we were in West Virginia and in Arizona. Not to say that would have completely made the difference, but you know, I really do believe had Senator Sinema and Senator Manchin been under a lot more pressure than they were, and we tried certainly, and they were under a lot, but if that pressure had been much earlier, much stronger, we would have seen a different outcome with the voting rights, with the John Lewis Voting Rights, Voting Advancement Act and the Freedom to Vote Act, both of which failed because of the lack of political courage and political imagination of two senators. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was a really crushing temporary defeat.
Yep.
But I've been reminding myself that, you know, back in the 1960s, the civil rights leaders were told time and time again that a voting rights bill was impossible, that it was dead in the water. And even by Lyndon Johnson, when King went to, I don't know if you've seen the movie Selma, but it really catches up well. It's like, I've cast all my political chits. And King's like, okay, goes and organizes in Selma and creates the political will, if you will, that ultimately got the Voting Rights Act passed in 1965. I think we're in a similar kind of moment right now where we've got to do that local work. And part of what you can do, and I know this isn't always comfortable, but we have to do the work of convincing people in your churches that the last election wasn't stolen, the big lie is a lie, and that it is a poison within our democracy, and that these efforts to try to restrict the vote are not just a partisan issue, they're really a faith issue. And you know, I'm kind of really exasperated by the ways in which the big lie has actually gotten a heck of a lot worse since the January 6th insurrection. I mean, that seems crazy to me. And yet it shows that, unfortunately, a lot of these things are very deep seated. And I think a lot of people are in their own echo chambers. And a lot of people are not hearing their pastor, not to put all the pressure on the pastor, but they do have a responsibility in this, to say to their congregation very clearly, look, I am not here to be a partisan. I'm not here to convince you to vote one way or the other. But we have to be truth tellers. Jesus said the truth will set us free. And it is clear that this last election was not stolen. And these efforts to try to make it more difficult to vote, you can quibble with some of the policy details, but this overall thrust is not in line with our faith values. And I have not seen nearly enough, or we have not seen nearly enough courage by pastors to communicate that kind of message. I don't think it's too late. There's still opportunity to do so, but we need a lot more of that. And we've got a campaign that you can learn more about if you just type in turnoutsunday.com. It's a collaboration between Sojourners and the Skinner Leadership Institute. And we took a campaign that was called Lawyers and Collars Turnout Sunday from this last election, realized in light of the big lie, in light of these 400 plus bills that have been proposed around the country to make more difficult to vote, that we had to expand this campaign. So our new kind of umbrella campaign is called Face United to Save Democracy. And we are literally mobilizing a multi-faith, multi-generational, multi-racial campaign to save our democracy. And it's particularly active in kind of 10 battleground states, but the tools that we've developed, there's a whole toolkit you can download, literally can be, you know, applied to any state in the country, including California and elsewhere.
Yeah, and I think for a lot of Californians, I shouldn't say that. I don't want to make it. I think sometimes in my mind, I think, oh, I live in California. You know, we have, a Democrat, you know, we're governor. We've got Democrats in our legislative control. So how can I help in, like, what do I need to worry about other states for? But I do. I have to be out there advocating and supporting other states where the work has to get done. And it's being able to secure that message. I had a conversation 3 days ago with a white woman, Christian woman. She does not go to our church, who literally said, there is no racism in this country and we do not need anything named social justice. It's not even relevant. And she goes to a church in our community. And I was like, it was just, so the lie that, and she says she has all the facts. She has all the facts. Right. And I have only opinions. That's what she said to me.
You only have opinions.
I only have opinions. It was great. I was like, oh, this is awesome. I'm going to leave. Right. I'm moving away.
Well, I mentioned this. There's at least, I think, two gaps that we have to close. One is called the narrative gap and the other is a relational gap. So we've talked a little bit about the narrative gap where, you know, people are kind of getting information within their own ecosystem or their own bubble. Yes. It's often just reaffirming their existing worldview. Mm-hmm. So that's a huge problem. I still think the church can play a key role in disrupting that. But the other is a relational gap. There was a survey, and I quote this in the book, called the American Value Survey. And they asked Americans across the country to explain who is in their close social circle. And 70% of white Americans did not have a single person of color in their close social circle. So these are people that could be a neighbor, a coworker, could be, you know, someone they're friends with in their school, but basically someone they trust, right? Not a single one. Yeah. And so if we are that relationally separated, segregated, it doesn't surprise me that, you know, you can have people that just don't understand, like, why my Black wife and I have to have a conversation with our sons very soon about how to respond if they ever are pulled over or have an interaction with a police officer. Not because all police officers are bad, but because of the systemic racism that is unfortunately still tied into policing in America, let alone, you know, lots of other examples I could point to. And so, you know, again, there's no quick fixes for these, but I actually think that over time we can fix it. We can change it. Like, we can get people to build more relationships outside their comfort zone. And hearing and knowing the story of someone is humanizing. Mm-hmm. It helps you see their divinity, right?
Yes, and amen.
That's exactly what we need. I'll just share, you know, I talk about this book too, but I've been deeply influenced by my time and experiences in South Africa. And I've learned a lot about this African philosophy called Ubuntu, which I like to describe as the golden rule on steroids.
Yeah.
And Ubuntu literally can be kind of, well, you know, Desmond Tutu, who, you know, sadly left us this year, describes it as I am because we are. Mm-hmm. But I learned a lot of Zulu when I was studying there in 1997. I've forgotten most of it, but the greeting in Zulu for like, how are you, essentially, is called Sawubona. And then the response is Siyakhona. And what it really means is, my brother or my sister, I see you. Mm. And then the response is, I am seen. And it's based on this understanding, this belief that I cannot be who I'm meant to be. I cannot be fully seen until you see me. You see my humanity. You see my divinity. And I think we need so much more of that, right?
Yeah.
And one of the commitments that I think would be so revolutionary in our politics right now, and I know this is hard. It's hard for me, but we have to take Jesus seriously and the commitment to love our enemies, right? Yeah. Like, there is so much vitriol and distrust in our politics. I mean, literally polling is showing that the majority of Republicans and the majority of Democrats not only dislike people in the other party, but they hate them. They have contempt for them. Mm-hmm. And instead of wanting to convince them or persuade them about, you know, whatever issue, they literally just want to defeat them. Mm-hmm. So we're in this like dangerous situation where it's like, if that is the playing field,
yep.
No wonder why we have a party in particular right now, and you know, Democrats also can be guilty of this too, but I think let's not create a false equivalency. I think the Republicans are more guilty right now of this like us versus them, zero sum, winner take all style of politics.
Yeah.
That I think is gonna, you know, literally lead us to chaos and collapse over time. So anyway, I'm not trying to scare everyone, but I'm just trying to emphasize that like I think we have some of the most powerful anecdotes in our possession with a commitment to love our enemies, with a commitment to love our neighbors, with a commitment to Imago Dei, you know, yeah. The very Beatitudes that I try to describe in the book, that we just need to use more. We need to apply it more. We need to live it out more courageously.
Yeah. And we're coming up to a time boundary, and I just have a couple of like concluding questions, but one of the ones that we're not even going to get into is you mention an article from The Atlantic by Jeffrey Goldblum about civil war. And there literally was a week ago in the front page of the Union Tribune, which is our local paper, a scholar from UCSD who has studied civil wars her entire career, a professor, and she writes about how close is the United States? And there is like a polity scale. And we were at like a 5, which is not good. We've bumped up to an 8, but I don't know where we are right now. And she talks about, you know, how to get to a place where there's not civil war. And I don't know. So I think that your thoughts are spot on, sadly, but anyway. Okay. Before we sign off. I don't want to leave yet. We're not going to leave just right. yet, because I do want to end on a positive note. I first want to ask, does anybody have any final questions? I just want to give you space to do that. Thank you, Claire, for posting that in the UT. It's a good read. So that we can add on a positive note, just give us a couple of key takeaways from this book. We'll just end with the last one, key takeaways that you'd love us to walk away with. I know for me, I've got a lot of work to do. And so, but what are just some key things you want us to walk away with?
One is that building the beloved community is not just about struggle. Yes, there's struggle tied into it, but it's also about joy. It's about the experience of being in community with others, particularly with people that are different than you. And know that can be hard, but it also can be so amazing. And I think is what the kingdom of God is going to look like. I mean, if some people don't want to interact with others now, they're going to be pretty unhappy in heaven when they see people of all backgrounds worshiping God and glorifying the Lord. So I really think that, you know, the journey is almost as important as the destination. Mm-hmm. And so you know, it is this journey that we're on of trying to co-create together the beloved community. And it can be a beautiful journey. It can be a joyous one. So I want to emphasize that. The second one is that I wrote a letter to my sons at the very end of the book. I actually wrote it on my favorite rock in this place called Bellingham, Washington, which was where I was born. And I wrote it the summer before the election actually happened of 2020. So I didn't know what the election outcome would be. But I basically wrote this letter to my sons to say, like, you know, one, our faith has everything you need in order to withstand whatever happens. And that your generation is going to get this right. And I'm not saying that to put, you know, all this burden on them, but I really believe, you know, we still need to create the right path. And there's a lot of things that we need to do now that are going to protect our democracy, let alone, you know, kind of combat so much of that polarization that we see in our midst. But I really feel like this next generation is already seeing things differently and, you know, really has the chance to kind of get America on the right track and ultimately make liberty and justice for all real for everyone. And so the last thing I'll just say is that, you know, I've got to constantly remind myself, I'm a big gospel music fan. There's one of my favorite songs is by Yolanda Adams. And, you know, the refrain is, this battle is not yours, it's the Lord's.
Amen.
You know, there's a real risk in all of this that you burn out, right?
Yeah.
And I have to remind myself that, like, ultimately, we are God's hands and feet. We are God's instruments. Mm-hmm. This battle is God's. God, you know, works in and through us, mm-hmm. and we need each other in the midst of it. And ultimately, our wholeness, our flourishing is tied into the flourishing and wholeness of others, you know, kind of tied into Isaiah 58. And so I've certainly been able to experience that in my career of being involved in activism. You don't have to make it your full-time job like I have, but I do think it's part and parcel to Christian discipleship.
Amen. Amen. That's a preacher ending right there. Well, we just want to thank you so much for taking this time. There's so much more that we could certainly dig into, and we just appreciate the work you're doing. It is a model for us. So we thank you. Anybody else have a final thought that they want to share? Okay. Well, if you're ever in Southern California, look us up. We'd love to.
I will do that
for lunch or dinner. We are here. We're small, but we're mighty, and we're trying to make stuff happen. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's a joy being with you, and I will let you know for sure.
All right. Thank you so much. Take care. All right. Bye-bye.